Good morning. Members, friends, and visitors are welcomed here without regard to their ethnicity, age, wealth, political affiliation, sexual orientation, education, marital status, or any other of the boxes into which society and doctors' offices want to place us. This should not be interpreted to mean that we have no standards. These words posted on the door at the Unitarian Church of Dublin, Ireland, reflect our views too. We bid you welcome to this house. It is a place we love and which we tend with care. We do not ask you to believe or expect you to think the way we do, but only that you try to live a kindly, helpful life with the dignity proper to a human being. Preachers here have the task of presenting religion fearlessly, freely, and faithfully. Hearers have the responsibility of testing what they hear, not only with the critical mind, but also in the living of everyday life. The members of this congregation welcome and support the support of all who believe that religion is wider than any sect and deeper than any set of opinions, and that all might find in their friendships here strength and encouragement for daily living. We add to this a further recommendation. When you wish to speak from the floor, you ask that you wait for the cordless microphone and hold it like this. And keep it there, elbow locked in place. If you feel the need to gesticulate, your free hand would be good for that. We do this because it helps to amplify your sound so everybody can hear them in the room, and so that people who have headsets can hear them more clearly, and so that it will be recorded for posterity, never to die. Speakers are not required to be succinct and considerate of others, but such efforts are appreciated. I have a couple of announcements to read. The chair of the music committee has asked me to tell you that the concert, the master's level piano recital concert for tomorrow night, by Shane Galantine, will start at 7:45 rather than the published time of 7:30, because somebody important, that is his teacher, can't get there until 7:45. And the other one is that our speaker has written a book, Moments in a Life, and it will be available for sale afterwards for $25, and the speaker has graciously offered to make a $3 donation to this congregation for each sale. So that makes it 22, doesn't it? You can deduct the other. As we light the chalice this morning, I think I'll do that first. As we light the chalice this morning, may we seek to be as much as possible like the Unitarians of Dublin, whose religion is wider than any sect and deeper than any set of opinions, as we try to live kindly, helpful lives. The opening hymn is number 40, The Morning Hangs a Signal. Great tune written by a Welsh farmer who is in the tradition of choral singing in that great part of Great Britain, and we will try to be worthy of his efforts. Please stand as you are able after an introduction and join in.
We could be good by the feet by the
I see that we call it pastoral care even when a very non-pastoral person is in charge. For this time when people have an opportunity to talk about their passages in life, birthdays, celebrations, things that cause them great joy and some concerns, and please, as instructed, wait for the microphone to show up.
I just want to let you know that Alan Yonke is in the hospital, was taken there this weekend, and he has pneumonia. So he'll be in intensive care for a while. You don't need to see him, but a card might be appreciated.
Bryce Hobrock. Shirley and I will celebrate our 30th wedding anniversary tomorrow. And there will be no public celebration because every day is a celebration of our marriage. And tomorrow, the 29th of April, happens to be also my parents' wedding anniversary. Sort of an accident, I guess, but I guess alive at 105 is the only way to describe my mother. We visited her Friday in Plainville, and I have suspended printing her eulogy because I'm not sure if the dates will be right.
Spring Boker, my birthday's coming up on the 4th of May, and it's also Beltane, and it's also Free Comic Book Day, so I got three things, good things going on that day. So, yeah.
In the front, Kath.
Oh, I missed one. Sorry, Renee.
Hi, I'm Renee Hawley, and I just wanted to say that recently you all decided that I could be a permanent substitute for the piano, and I'm really excited about that, and I'm honored to join you all, and thank you to Mr. and Mrs. Oldfather and anyone who had a part in it, so thank you very much.
I have a joy that on tomorrow that I'm going to go to Legoland. I'm also going to get a brace appointment, but I have a concern that I can eat that day.
Oh. Well, those joys and concerns unspoken, we share with you as best we can. And now, a reading, followed by the choir.
I have to figure out where it went. Before creation, a presence existed, self-contained, complete, formless, voiceless, mateless, changeless, which yet pervaded itself with unending motherhood. Though there can be no name for it, I have called it the way of life. Perhaps I should have called it the fullness of life. Since fullness implies widening into space, implies still further widening, implies widening until the circle is whole. In this sense, the way of life is fulfilled, heaven is fulfilled, earth fulfilled, and a fit person also is fulfilled. There are four amplitudes of the universe, and a fit person is one of them. Humanity rounding the way of earth. Earth rounding the way of heaven. Heaven rounding the way of life. Till the circle is full.
We need some young people to come up here, and I need a microphone to do my part.
Order Dirkus.
I don't know whether parents and teachers still read nursery rhymes or recite them to children. It's been a long time since I had that kind of job to do. Do any of you know any nursery rhymes? Any? There was an old. Which one do you know? What? Which one? Oh, the cow jumped over the moon. All right, that's one. To catch a pail of water. All right, okay. And a bunch more. Well, I'm going to tell you about one of them. Oh, you remember one? There wasn't a woman who lived in a shoe? Well, maybe you'll think of it later, and you can share it with us. Well, I'm going to tell you about one that's relevant to the sermon that we're going to hear later, I think. And this is, you need to know a couple of words. One is, he is going to a fair. Now, it's not like a fair with Ferris wheels. It's more like, the farmer's market. that we have here in town. Have you ever been to the farmer's market? Yeah, where people would have things to sell. And there is another word that's not commonly used these days. Do you know what a warehouse is? What's a warehouse? Oh.
A place where things are kept.
What kinds of things?
Like industrial things?
Yeah, well, things you're going to sell. So where, the first part of it, refers to, you know, what you have to sell. Okay, one more thing is the word penny is used here for money. And the penny of the time when this was written was, first of all, quite a lot bigger than the penny that we get in change and don't bother with, you know. And it was worth a lot more than it is now. So let me read to you. Simple Simon met a pieman going to the fair. Said Simple Simon to the pieman, "Let me taste your ware." Said the pieman to Simple Simon, "Show me first your penny." Simple Simon said to the pieman, "Indeed, I have not any." He thought he was going to get a taste for nothing. Simple Simon. There are lots and lots of different stories that circulated around 100, 200, 300 years ago about Simple Simon, who was often referred to as a simpleton. Is simpleton something you would like to be called? I don't think so. And there's some words that are a lot like that that we wouldn't want to hear on the playground or hear anyplace else. But let me tell you just a couple more things about him. He went to catch a dicky bird and thought that he would not fail because he had a little salt to put on its tail. Catch a bird by putting salt on its tail? Well, if you get close enough to put salt on it, you can grab him. But birds, they don't like that. This is one of my favorite verses. Simple Simon went a-fishing for to catch a whale. Well, first off, what's wrong with that if you go fishing for a whale? What? Well, that's right. It'd be big. But what else? Do you fish for a whale? That's right. All right. And there's the rest of it. But is the whale a fish? No, it's not a fish. Yeah, that's right. It's a mammal. Yeah, all right. Okay, Simple Simon went a-fishing to catch a whale, and all the water that he had got was in his mother's pail. So he's fishing in a bucket, you know, a little pail. He wasn't too swift. Simple Simon went to look if plums grew on a thistle, you know, a sticker bush. He pricked his finger very much, which made poor Simon whistle. Well, we're going to hear a sermon about a simpleton who is treated more respectfully than Simple Simon. I don't know what Reverend Knapp is going to do with it, but I've been around him long enough to know that we're going to wind up maybe even wishing we were that simpleton, not this character famous in around the world. So, all right. I think it'd be a good time for you to go with your friends where you have some fun and leave it to us here to not have much fun. Right. Go now in peace. Go now in peace. May the spirit of love surround you everywhere, everywhere. For many of you, an introduction for Ron Knapp is not necessary, but I have to tell you, he has had an important role to play in this congregation's life for many years. He has driven down from Omaha or someplace close to Omaha where he lived, and among other things, he gave the inspirational talk at the meeting where we launched our fund drive to build this addition to our building, and I don't know that too many people got their wallets and checkbooks out immediately, but we got to them pretty soon before the glow wore off, and we're grateful to the many times that he has been here, workshops that he's led, and on fundraising and on other things. It's a great addition, a great pleasure. I won't talk about how long we've known each other, but I'll tell you something. We were both a whole lot younger, and we were still paying into Social Security. Ron Knapp.
Reading from the Tao Te Ching. First, the breath of life. The breath of life moves through a deathless valley of mysterious motherhood, which conceives and bears the universal seed. The seeming of a world never to end, breath for men to draw from as they will, and the more they take of it, the more remains. The universe is deathless. Is deathless because, having no finite self, it stays infinite. Acceptance. Be utterly humble, and you shall hold to the foundation of peace. Be at one with all these living things which, having arisen and flourish, return to the quiet whence they came. Like a healthy growth of vegetation, falling back upon the root. Acceptance of this return to the root has been called quietism. Acceptance of quietism has been condemned as fatalism. But fatalism is acceptance of destiny. And to accept destiny is to face life with open eyes, whereas not to accept destiny is to face death blindfolded. One who is open-eyed is open-minded. One who is open-minded is open-hearted. One who is open-hearted is kingly. One who is kingly is godly. One who is godly is useful. One who is useful is infinite. One who is infinite is immune. One who is immune is immortal. Existence. Existence is beyond the power of words to define. Terms may be used, but are none of them absolute. In the beginning of heaven and earth, there were no words. Words came out of the womb of matter. And whether a man dispassionately sees to the core of life or passionately sees the surface, the core and the surface are essentially the same, words making them seem different, only to express appearance. If name be needed, wonder names them both. From wonder unto wonder, existence opens.
This is the time when we take the offering. Wish I could tell you we didn't need it, but we do. While we listen to a little bit of Debussy. Thank you.
Everyone says that my way of life is the way of a simpleton. Being largely the way of a simpleton is what makes it worthwhile. If it were not the way of a simpleton, it would long ago have been useless. Three possessions of a simpleton being the three I choose and cherish: to care, to be fair, to be humble. When a man cares, he is unafraid. When he is fair, he leaves enough for others. When he is humble, he can grow. Whereas if, like men of today, he be bold without caring, self-indulgent without sharing, self-important without shame, he is dead. The invincible shield of caring is a weapon from the sky against being dead. This morning, I want to present a scholarly, erudite, rational, comprehensive critique, an analysis of this bit of wisdom from Lao Tzu and from the Tao Te Ching. There are at least three reasons for my doing so. The first of these reasons has to do with the fact that Lao Tzu limits the possessions of a simpleton to three. And three just happens to be a magic number for preachers. Three is important not in and of itself, but it is important because it is thrust on him by the magic number 20 and by the greatest magic number of all, 60, the most powerful number in the world of the preacher. The magic number 60 has to do with absolutes, with the unforgivable sin, with the most important thou shalt not of the preaching profession. Thou shalt not extend the service past 1 hour. At that time, when the preacher dares to violate the rule of 60, all eyes turn away from the eloquent articulation of religious truth being presented and focus on the clock on the wall in the back of the church. The Apostle Paul, well known as a great preacher, once violated the magic number of 60, and that led to some very dire consequences. You don't believe me? Well, this is what the scriptures say in the book of Acts. As Paul spoke on and on and on, a young man named Eutychus, sitting on the windowsill, became very drowsy. Finally, he fell sound asleep and dropped three stories to his death below. After that time, wise preachers have tended to be very cautious about that magic number of 60. Now, the magic number 20 has to do with some technical pragmatics and allegedly, at least, with certain aspects of human psychology. If the church service can be no more than 60 minutes in length, and if there are numerous other things you want or need or are required to do, like hymns and prayers and announcements and children's stories and joys and concerns and all that kind of stuff, there remains at most 20 minutes for the sermon. Now, by some act of divine providence, that tends to correlate precisely with the universal perception of the sermonic attention span. And what this comes down to in the real world of the preacher is, if you don't get him in 20 minutes, you're not going to get him at all. And this is where the magic number 3 comes into the picture. Probably not as important as 20 or 60, but pretty important nevertheless. The truth is that if you only have 20 minutes for a sermon, there's only a limited number of things you can say. And by custom as old as preaching itself, that number is 3. Every graduate of a seminary, every newborn bard of the Holy Spirit, to use Emerson's phrase, is taught a particular 3-in-1 model. 1, tell them what you're going to tell them. 2, tell them. And 3, tell them what you told them. Now, although many ministers use this kind of model, many of us feel uneasy with it. There are supposed to be 3 points in a sermon, and within sermonic limitations, one is expected to get in all the licks one can. And as a Unitarian still further, one might question the authenticity of such a Trinitarian formulation. But it is hallowed by the ages and does have a certain kind of internal integrity. For how in the world could anyone give a sermon on the noble eightfold path of Gautama Buddha? Right belief, right aspiration, right speech, right conduct, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right contemplation, and still remain true to the magic 20. Or to use an even more extreme situation, how could one give a sermon on the 10 commandments, on adultery, idolatry, stealing, and all that stuff, and still remain faithful to the God of 60? And in this regard, Lao Tzu is a preacher's preacher. He's one of us. With Lao Tzu, the magic number 3 comes up all the time. Try to imagine with what delight the preacher's eye focuses on Lao Tzu's 3 treasures: love, moderation, humility. Being loving, one can be brave. Being moderate, one can be ample. Not venturing to go ahead in the world, one can be the chief of all officials. Or try to imagine how the preacher salivates like Pavlov's dogs and approaches with exquisite joy Lao Tzu's "You seek wisdom, goodness, and contentment. In the ways you're trying to attain them, you are blind and foolish. Can you not see that wisdom is truth, goodness is acceptance, and contentment is simplicity?" So that's the first reason for giving this sermon. Lao Tzu does all the work for me. He breaks down the truth into 3 pieces, comes up with a ready-made outline, and all I have to do is fill in some blanks. My second reason for giving this sermon has to do with this interesting character, Lao Tzu, about his powerful little book, The Tao Te Ching, and some of the weirder aspects of Taoism, which followed. Lao Tzu, it is said, was born sometime around 604 BCE. The truth is, however, that like Jesus of Nazareth, we do not know if he actually existed or not. And if he did, we know almost nothing about him. We do not even know his name. The word Lao Tzu are not a name, but a title of respect. Like, they mean something like the old man, or the old wise guy, or the old master. What we do know about Lao Tzu, or what we think we know about him, again like Jesus, arose generations, perhaps centuries, after his alleged birth by devout adherents of Taoist faith. Taoist tradition says that again like Jesus, Lao Tzu was immaculately conceived, except that his mother wasn't inseminated by the Holy Spirit. She was inseminated by a shooting star. Now, those mothers in the congregation who have experienced difficulties in childbirth may do well to consider the case of Lao Tzu's mother. Taoist tradition tells us that Lao Tzu remained in his mother's womb for 62 years and emerged from the womb as an old man with a full gray beard, and then went on to live 999 years longer. Taoist tradition also tells us that Lao Tzu was a keeper of the archives in one of the Chinese provinces, and that he grew tired with the responsibilities of his physician and decided to go to some remote place on the other side of the frontier of the empire where he could be by himself. When he approached the guards on the frontier, they would not let him pass until he wrote down his thoughts. So Lao Tzu spent 3 days writing, and the result was the Tao Te Ching, which can be roughly translated as the way of life. What we do know is that the Tao Te Ching is one of the great classics of religious literature. It is said that the Tao Te Ching has been translated into more languages than any other book except the Christian Bible. It is a wonderful example of wisdom literature that speaks to the hearts and minds of millions of people. And it speaks to me. The eminent scholar of world religions, Houston Smith, referred to the Tao Te Ching as, quote, a testament to man's at-homeness in the universe. A testament to man's at-homeness in the universe. And that is precisely what I think liberal religion, Unitarian Universalism, ought to be all about. A testament to human at-homeness in the universe. But as Taoism developed, it descended into all kinds of superstitious nonsense, such as magics, evil spirits, sorceries, exorcisms, telling the future by reading the entrails of chickens. It also developed some pretty weird teachings, some of which were ascribed even to the master himself. The result appears to be a mixture of wisdom and foolishness. I can appreciate, for example, the notion that the world moves according to a divine pattern, which is reflected in the rhythmic and orderly movements of nature. And I can appreciate the beauty in Lao Tzu's idea of quiet simplicity, of a life which flows with the impersonal flow of nature. But what in the world can I do with the admonitions, also from the traditions of Taoism, don't sing or dance on the last day of the month, or on the last day of the year, or don't shout or get angry on the first day of the month, or in the morning? I can appreciate the notion that the sum of wisdom and happiness for the human being involves adjusting oneself to the order of the universe. I can appreciate that individual human beings find wisdom and happiness when they reflect in their own lives the way the world moves. And I can be instructed by the thought, one feels a pleasurable sensation before he smiles, and smiles before he thinks he ought to smile. Resign yourself, therefore, to the proper sequence of things. But what in the world can I possibly do with don't weep or spit towards the north, or don't spit towards shooting stars, or don't point at rainbows? I can appreciate the sage wisdom in being cautious, thoughtful, not being overbearing. I can appreciate the humor in the notion that a ruler ought to govern a great city as he would cook a fish, gently. But what in the world can I do with Don't listen to what your wife or concubine say. Fortunately or unfortunately, I don't have any concubines. But what do you think might happen if I did not take seriously what Anne had to say? Perhaps a lesson one could gather from this is that one should take all of the religious traditions of the world, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Taoism, Confucianism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Unitarian Universalism, with a note of skepticism. Perhaps we ought to season the wisdom of the great sages of human history, from Lao Tzu to the Dalai Lama, from Socrates to Bertrand Russell, from Jesus to Walt Whitman, with a grain of salt. Now, a third reason for giving this sermon on the three possessions of a simpleton has to do with my own personal, philosophical, intellectual, religious proclivities. I use that word proclivity with its negative connotation of bias and of a natural propensity towards something objectionable, advisedly. People are often surprised when I say from the pulpit, as I have often said from the pulpit, that whereas I like both people and ideas, I think I love ideas more. I see myself in what I think is the best meaning of the word as a metaphysician. I love to deal with the ultimate meaning of things. It is a meaning of the cosmos that attracts me. To seek after truth and perchance to discover it. Ah, that is the greatest of callings. So I like to think of myself as being akin to Jacob in the scriptures, who wrestles with an angel and will not let him go until the angel blesses him. There's nothing I enjoy more than wrestling with some great idea and to follow it as far as I can go. I like to think that in my religious and intellectual life, I've tried to follow the exhortation of John Tyndall in what was a famous Belfast address. It is perfectly possible for you and me to purchase intellectual peace at the price of intellectual death. The world is not without refuges of this description, nor is it wanting in persons who seek their shelter and try to persuade others to do the same. The unstable and the weak have yielded and will yield to this persuasion, and they to whom repose is sweeter than the truth. But I would exhort you to refuse the offered shelter, to scorn the base repose, to accept, if the choice be forced upon you, commotion before stagnation, the breezy leap of the torrent before the fetid stillness of the swamp. That defines me. But when I consider the fact that ideas may be more important to people, I need to continually remind myself that must not mean that people are therefore unimportant. So it's then I am reminded and need to remind myself of a lovely little poem by Carl Sandburg titled Happiness. I asked the professors who teach the meaning of life to tell me, what is happiness? And I went to famous executives who boss the work of thousands of men. They all shook their heads and gave me a smile as though I was trying to fool with them. And then, one Sunday afternoon, I wandered out along the Des Plaines River, and I saw a crowd of Hungarians under the trees, with their women and children and a keg of beer and an accordion. That's the meaning of life. On the thinking, feeling segment of the Briggs-Meyer inventory, I am almost off the scale on the thinking side. And I expect that's one of the reasons why I am a Unitarian rather than a Methodist anymore. Critical thought has always been central to our heritage, and it's always been central to me. But every once in a while, I need to remind myself that whereas thinking is of central importance, that should not mean that feelings are unimportant. I'm a rationalist who needs to remind himself that intuition is also important. For me, the intellectual life takes precedence over the emotional life. I expect that's another reason why I'm a Unitarian Universalist rather than a Methodist. Intellectual criticism of religious ideas has been a continuing aspect of our faith. And as many of my sermons suggest, including some I've given here, I am terribly afraid right now that contemporary Unitarian Universalism is losing the intellectual edge that has always made it what it ought to be. As someone who loves to deal with the profound, sometimes need to make room for the simple. So, as it turns out, I'm rapidly approaching the magic 60, which means I'm not going to be able to give a scholarly, intellectual, erudite, rational critique of Lao Tzu's poem after all. The 20 minutes allotted to sermonic presentation is about up. I've gone through my 3 points, so I have to call it a day. I only want to add that today I am one of Lao Tzu's simpletons, and I'm going to let him speak for himself. It's a message that everyone should hear. It's a message that everyone should heed. Care. Be fair. Be humble. Listen. Perhaps you too can hear Lao Tzu saying, "Amen." Or if one expects even Lao Tzu to be politically correct, so be it.
Many years ago, I went to hear Abby Hoffman give a talk, and it was in a chapel of a Methodist college, university, and there had been rumors of lots of trouble, and so the football team was placed around the exterior to retain order, and these were some big guys, and we don't have anything like that. But when he finished, he said, "Are there any answers out there?" And so we will accept either answers or questions for a time. I think Ron will do that, and he will unscrew the unscrutable for us and other acts of, of magic, I would say. And then we will break for a little bit of liquid refreshment and some other things like that. But Ron, you have the microphone. And wait for the microphone to come.
All right.
With your answers.
Hi. Anna Franklin. Well, with regard to not spitting at the North Star, I think that makes a lot of sense if you think about it. You know, spitting upward, right? It's not a good idea. And I think there may be some other explanations for some of those other things if you really, really think about them. And as for emotion and intellect being two separate things, I think I disagree with that. I think they're very, very, very close. That's all I can say.
I don't know if I should respond to that or not, but for me, emotion is an element of my intellect. Even grieving is meant for me a mental process and not as it is something else. When my mother died, my sister fell apart. For me, I grieved, but it was not emotionally, it was mentally. It was thinking about a human relationship. And that's part of who I am, and that's what I tried to say in my third point. That's who I am. And you have to accept me as I am, but I realize that what I am is not the only answer.
Hi, Bob Patterson. I'll begin humble, and I'm sure you can keep me humble.
What? I didn't get it.
My question is, I think I heard you say that Unitarianism has lost its edge, and maybe I missed it, but I didn't hear an explanation for why that's happened or how your understanding has developed in that way.
What in the hell? I'm a simpleton. How would I know the answer for what is developing? If you know me and sermons I've also given here, I think we are Unitarian Universalism is currently in the fifth year of a decline, and I believe it is because we are no longer the central intellectual religious force on the left spring of the religious spectrum. We're becoming more and more and more, in my opinion, like Protestant Christians, rather than what I think of as the wholly other type of religious organization that stands in contrast to them. And that contrast has been that we have always been the most educated religious movement in the country, and that the intellect has always been extremely important to us. I think it is losing its importance in the Unitarian religious world of today. That's what I mean by that. And it's terribly concerned. I think we're becoming a pretty soft religion, not religiously. When I tell people, as I tell people, and I'll tell you, that if I say something is true and you say something the opposite is true, there is only three possibilities. One, I'm right and you're wrong, or you're right and I'm wrong, or we're both wrong. There's no possible way that opposites can be both right. And yet many people will say that to me in response. I think we are required to argue about ideas. That's what Unitarianism is an argument about religious ideas. And the low point, it's in my book, by the way, the low point of my ministerial career is I went to a meeting of the Ministers Association where the very first thing that was said, the leader had on a T-shirt that said, "No, no, bad dog." And she said, if anybody wants to argue this week, we were discussing Unitarian Universalism in the 21st century. If anybody wants to argue this week, just say to them, "No, no, bad dog." Well, hell, in my opinion, there's no Unitarian Universalism at all worth saving if it is not where people argue about religious ideas that enables both arguers to grow.
My name is Mark, and there was a couple. Okay, there was a couple of striking things that I heard you say, with the response. One that was that Unitarianism is on the decline.
Is what?
On the decline. Is that what I heard?
Pardon? You said we were in the fifth year. Oh, fifth year of decline. Yes.
Okay.
That's what I understand to be the case.
Mm-hmm. And also that might be becoming a soft religion. And the Unitarians, they're about, it's about an argument about religious ideas, is that right?
About what?
An argument about religious ideas, is that right?
Yeah, I think that's what we're all about.
Okay.
We don't not. People seem to think that you have to not like each other to argue with them, but that's not true. Trying to think who was a minister for many years up in Soup, up in St. Paul. He was a. I'm a humanist. You know, he was a theist. We argued all the time and loved each other. I mean, that's what I think Unitarianism is about.
Okay. So, as far as like answering instead of asking a question, I saw, and it, this might indicate that we need to change something on the the board outside, but. It said that Unitarianism is growing, grow from 180,000 to 211,000, and so I'm not sure if that was within.
Is there a sign out there that says that?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know if that means we need to up to our board, or I don't know who's responsible for that. so,
well, I need to say that when we talk about a decline over the last 5 years, it is a fraction of a percent a year, but seems to me to be indicative that we're not growing.
Okay, and so I didn't hear a an explanation for why we're becoming a soft religion, but I thought if we are on the rise, maybe are the growth is what is propagating the that impression that maybe we're having younger people that are maybe less wise, or maybe, I'm not sure, but I didn't understand or hear your explanation on that. And the other one, the last thing, I just wanted to clarify, make sure I was clear on what you said, that if Unitarianism is about religious ideas, discussing religious ideas, that's talking about the theoretical, is that right? We're talking about the theoretical, and I was wondering if you could maybe expound on that. So if Unitarian is about religious ideas, could you expound on, because I believe that would be theoretical. You're talking about theoretical theories. Something.
Do you mean by theoretical theological?
No, I mean, because ideas, if you use a theory or a hypothesis is an idea that you can use, and so if you're coming up with a theory, it's like an explanation, and so how do we use the religious ideas to explain? What do we use that for? Is that a clear question?
Yeah, I'm not sure. What I mean is an argument about religious ideas, and let me just say what I think is central. In the 21st century, there are two scientific ideas that ought to be central in Unitarian Universalist theology. The first developed in the began developing in the 19th century, and that is evolutionary biology, that every living thing in the world, including this thing, is related. We're all brothers and sisters, all living. That ought to be central in Unitarian theology. The second thing is in the beginning with the middle of the 20th century, is cosmic evolution. We now know that everything, that there's a oneness to the universe, that everything, animate and inanimate, is part of a single evolutionary process. And I will argue with anybody about that. That ought to be a central I have trouble waving my arm. Ought to be a central message of Unitarian Universalism. And I sometimes feel I'm like the only guy that's saying that. And that is what needs to be said, is that religion for Unitarians ought to square and ought to advance and grow and square with understanding, contemporary understanding of the nature of the universe. And not to some previous universe, which is, I think, educated and concerned liberal Protestants have real trouble, because a good deal of what is taught in Christianity defies what we know about the nature of the universe in the 21st century. And our position is to be the gadfly. like Socrates, the gadfly of the religious world. And I don't know what theoretical means. I'm talking about theological and religious ideas when I talk about it. And I think I gave my sermon here, didn't I, on climbing on a horse and riding off in all four directions. That's what I think is the big problem, is our obsession with diversity. Not that I have any quarrel with diversity, but we cannot make it our primary principle. The value of diversity is that it gives us people to argue with. That's why it gives us people to compare our religious ideas with. That's what makes diversity. But we're almost to the point where we say to people, it doesn't matter what you believe. Anybody different beliefs are here. Well, for me, it makes a hell of a lot of difference what people believe. And I think for people, they ought to argue about it. Now, I have gone on with my windbagging for quite a while. Should we? What do you think?
Well, I would just say that I agree. I'm an arguer, and I love to argue. But not everyone likes to argue. And many, many people prefer to dwell in a different state of mind than...
On what?
They don't burn with intellectual discussion, you know. And some people do, and some people don't. And I think, you know, there's a place for... And that's why we have to have tolerance. There's a place for people who need to have repetitive rituals. They need to have something from the past, that something like tradition, something that they can still agree on. And they need to, I'm not saying everyone, but many people need to feel as though everyone that they're with agrees with them and that no one's going to challenge them. I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm just saying that's human nature for a lot of people. And it's not my way, but a lot of people feel that way. And I'm a human being, and I understand it. So that's all.
Well, let me add one more thing, is that the other side of my life,
thanks.
Anybody who knows me, is the other source of inspiration for my sermons is poetry. And you mentioned ritual. I love ritual. And that's in decline, in my opinion, in Unitarian Universalism. Good ritual during Sunday morning services that flow, where things flow from the beginning to the next thing, to the next thing, to the end. And I love ritual, too. And I love poetry, which speaks to my, quote, soul, even though I don't have any idea what in the hell the word soul means. And that we all need that.
On the issue of tradition and such, there was a story a long time called The Lottery, if any of you ever remember it, where people did the same thing every year for our tradition. Basically, in the end, they stoned some guy to death, but they said it's because of tradition. But tradition and stuff is important and all that, and ritual is important, but if you stick with the same thing over and over again, especially if you don't know what started it, you might stagnate or be doing the wrong thing at the same time because it's just the same way things are done.
Yeah, you can't do the same thing over and over again. Let me just add another segue here. We sang the hymn, the first hymn you mentioned, the music. The hymn was written by the greatest turn of the 20th century Unitarian hymn writer, the one first Morning Hangs a Signal. I go to all kinds of fellowships and churches now where all they sing, in my opinion, are ditties. They don't sing any of the classic Unitarian hymns. And I think we don't want to lose touch of our heritage, don't want to lose touch with our forefathers and foremothers of the 19th century, of the 20th century. And I think, again, we're losing it because we would like not to sing hymns that we have to learn to sing. Well, now I'm...
Yeah, over here. All right. Matt. I just wanted to add one more thing, which is I'm also a big fan of argument, and I like tradition and I like tolerance, but there's also a big difference between things like tradition and tolerance, and there's a difference between ritual and habit, and there's a difference between tolerance and complacence. And just because we want to be welcoming doesn't mean that we want to be challenging. I know that it's a big deal for me that what I'm presented with is intellectually rigorous and welcomes a certain amount of intellectual rigor. Or else, why would I waste any of my intellectual rigor on it?
Huh? Yeah, well, yeah.
Do we have time for one more comment? Tom is the next in the queue here.
Okay, we'll let Tom Phillips. So I guess I would, for the sake of argument, hold the mic correctly and say that maybe Unitarians aren't the only ones that utilize critical thinking. Now, like yourself, I was a Methodist. My middle name is Wesley. And
my oldest son is named John Wesley.
Whoa, man. Well, so there's something called the Wesley Quadrilateral, which, of course, I had to look up on my phone. But the four items of the quadrilateral, as you know, are scripture, which would be the one really religious part, tradition. But then there's reason and experience. So, you know, I think I don't have enough experience as a Unitarian, although what I recognize right away is most fallen Methodists become Unitarians if they're going to affiliate. And so I really do welcome the arguments and the discussions that we have. But I've had them before in the United Methodist Church as well. And I
learned them in my book. You all need to buy a copy of it. But in my book, it says that the most important place in my life is North Prairie Methodist Church, in my whole life. And the most important influence in my life is the Methodist Youth Fellowship. And that lasts till this day. And in the Methodist Youth Fellowship, that's where I learned that it was okay to argue about religious ideas. So unlike many Unitarians, I don't have any antagonisms towards my past, religious past. It's just that I had to change.
Okay. Hi, Scott Tenona. So you, my guess is you would not disagree with this, but I want to just say the way I think about this, reason and argument and intellectual rigor and some of the other stuff that happens in Unitarian Universalism, what I care about is human flourishing, well-being, right, in the Aristotelian sense. And, you know, like we get from the old Greeks, is argument, self-reflection, critical thought is a really important part of that. But it's not the only part, right? And so that's where I think, right, so I can do that in a philosophy class or with other philosophers about certain kinds of things, right? But there's a difference coming here and doing it, and it shouldn't feel, for me, what I look for isn't a purely academic thing here, because I can get that plenty of other places, right? It's something else. And I'm sure you would sort of agree in the sense that it's, you know, the intellectual rigor is going to be part of a religious tradition, means something different than just writing a scholarly paper. But I think that's the way I think of finding the place of rigor in a religious tradition. We have to look at the whole picture.
What are we're going to sing?
We're going to sing a hymn, and then you're going to do the closing words.
Yeah.
I'll introduce the hymn. How's that?
All right, you introduce the hymn while I find those closing words.
Okay.
We have enough time. Let's sing "'Tis a Gift to Be Simple," and sing it once with the piano and then once without the piano. It's short. All right?
from Mosey, when all of the people of the world love, then the strong will not overpower the weak. The many will not oppress the few. The wealthy will not mock the poor. The honored will not disdain the humble. The cunning will not deceive the simple.
Thanks, Rob.